gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. It is my great privilege to introduce to you the head of the Tennessee Firearms Association, John Harris, who is a successful practicing attorney in Nashville, Tennessee, and he is the third generation of Harris's practicing law in Tennessee. Very impressive. My grandfather went to Vanderbilt. You went to Vanderbilt, so a fine Tennessee family. And John has particular expertise as an attorney, both leading the Tennessee Firearms Association and your practice area, too. You deal with firearms and explosive laws. And the Tennessee Firearms Association is an association I've been a member of for many years. I recommend them to you highly. And John, so welcome to the Solera Report, and thank you for everything you do for the state of Tennessee.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me on today.
So the Tennessee Firearms Association is a not-for-profit corporation, and it basically, you're working with both the U.S. Constitution and the Tennessee Constitution, and you are dealing with Second and Tenth Amendment issues and the right of Tennessee citizens to basically carry and own firearms, correct?
We cover almost every issue related to civilian ownership of firearms. We cover handgun permits, constitutional carry. We cover hunters. We cover purchase and sale laws. We cover range protection. We cover for hunters what's called no net loss, which is the access to public lands. Uh-huh. And then we also cover a restoration of rights for people who've had problems with the criminal code in the past, but have got their lives straightened out. Mm-hmm. And then we also deal with 10th Amendment issues as well.
So I just have to say that the reputation of the Tennessee Firearms Association is one of the finest reputations of any organization dealing with government I know of in Tennessee. And I know you've been honored by the legislature on numerous occasions. And my impression of one of the reasons you are so well respected is when I say you deal with the hard work of the detail of getting in the trenches and dealing with this issue, you get in the trenches and you work hard. And it's a big job.
It is a big job. And one of the things we bring to the table is the fact that I've been a practicing attorney in Tennessee and in Nashville for 36 years now. Right. And so I can look at these statutes, not just from the perspective of what's the words on the books, but I deal with them in the courtroom and I deal with them in terms of what judges have done, and including misconstruing the statutes, because in many instances they're poorly written. And it's a level of involvement that you don't typically get even with a paid lobbyist.
So let me step back for a second and just talk a little bit about Tennessee, because our subscribers are all over the world and not all of them know Tennessee as well as you or I do. And it's Tennessee is a very long state. I used to cross the border driving back from Washington. I'd cross in from Virginia and I'd call somebody and they'd say, "Oh, you're almost home." I said, "No, I got another 9 hours." So it's a long state and it goes all the way from Virginia over to the Mississippi River. And Nashville, where you are, is right in the, you know, you are right in the middle. But Tennessee is a state, it's got a very serious, hardworking legislature, and the bill flow is significant.
It
and
is.
My impression reading your updates is you're dealing with 50 to 75, even more bills a year.
We screened about 1,500 bills this year already.
Wow.
And we've pared that down to about 50 that we're actually tracking that we think relate to our subject matter issues of interest.
Wow. So talk a little bit about the people of Tennessee and how important gun ownership is to them.
Well, you know, that's a phenomenal question. And there's a lot of interesting data points on that. Tennessee is a state where, with almost 7 million people, the bulk of Tennesseans are very seriously invested in firearms ownership. And you can quantify that. I'll give you an example. In 1998, they passed a law that created the Tennessee Instant Check System, where if you go in to buy a gun, they keep track of it because there's a background check done, and TBI records that data. And the first full year of that data pool was 1999. And in that year, there were reportedly about 300,000 purchases by civilians of new or used firearms from federal firearms dealers.
And how many? Number,
about 300,000.
300,000.
In 1999. Right. That number stayed sort of consistent. It'd go up and down each year, you know, but it was sort of in the 300,000 range all the way to 2008. And then in 2008, something happened in the nation or in Tennessee, and that volume jumped up to about a half a million.
Right.
In 2008. And it stayed at 2008 at about a half a million a year all the way through 2019. And that's about a half a million guns a year being added to the civilian ownership,
right?
Each year, every year. And then in 2020, because of whatever the factors were, COVID, increased concern about government, you know, the direction it was going with the elections, they hit the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation reported that they hit that half million mark by the middle of the summer.
Wow.
And it would have been much higher, I believe, if it hadn't been for problems with availability of inventory.
Right.
And by the end of the year, it was about 700,000 guns. So we had about a 50% increase.
Wow.
Just last year, in a year in which inventory was hard to find.
Right.
And then the same thing is true about the handgun permits. The last number I saw on handgun permits is with a population of about 7 million, where over 700,000 Tennesseans have handgun carry permits.
So that's about 10%.
Yeah, it's a huge number. And we're told by the Department of Safety that the volume of people applying for new handgun permits almost doubled in 2020 monthly on a monthly basis.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I left Washington in 1998 and moved to Tennessee. And when I left, I told everyone, including, you know, sort of people who are all my subscribers now, that my number one issue having worked in Tennessee was the Second Amendment. I said, if there was one thing worth fighting and dying for, it was the Second Amendment. And many of them would say, why do you need a gun? It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand it. And it took many, many years for them to start to understand. But in the last 3 or 4 years, they've all sort of almost all come around. I put the quote at the beginning of the outline I sent you from a subscriber. I just got it from Australia when he said he heard we were going to do this interview today. And he said, don't ever make the mistake we made. Never give up your guns. If you look at what's happening here, it could never have happened unless we had given up our guns.
That is so true. And, you know, right. One thing, we do hear that a lot. People ask the question, why do you need a handgun, a sawed-off shotgun, a shotgun right. at all, an AR-15, anything that looks bad? And it always impresses me when I get that question that the person really hasn't studied the Constitution enough to understand that the Second Amendment, first off, it doesn't create the right. It recognizes a pre-existing right.
Right, right.
And it prohibits the government from infringing it. But secondly, it's not a needs-based provision in our Constitution. The Second Amendment is really there as a means of protecting the political right of right. the citizens of the country to own firearms. And the Tennessee Supreme Court has said this twice, that are suitable for military engagement.
Right.
And the Supreme Court in Tennessee has said, because if they have those kinds of weapons in their possession, they're best able to overthrow their own government if necessary.
I do love Tennessee. Okay, so let's turn to inalienable rights. Walk us through, I'm particularly interested, everybody here I think knows the Bill of Rights, but walk us through the Second Amendment and the 10th Amendment, but then I want you to talk a little bit about the Heller decision, because I think you had a recent podcast on it. It was a great and very coherent description of the importance of the Heller decision, and I think it's one that a lot of people aren't familiar with.
Yeah. Heller was a turning point that we've waited two centuries to receive.
Right.
What you find when you look at the history of the Second Amendment and the state constitutions that mirror it is that, as I mentioned a moment ago, the Second Amendment was recognizing a pre-existing right that at the time it was written, the founders understood was not created by government. It was not given by government. It's a right that existed independent of government and separate from government. And the Second Amendment merely says that the right of the people to own arms and the references to weapons of military significance
right.
shall not be infringed. And a lot of people look back at that militia clause, the preamble to it, and they misconstrue it. They think it somehow means citizens should only have guns if they're engaged in some kind of police or military service, when in fact it's just the opposite. At the time it was written, and even as of today, the militia is all able-bodied citizens in this country.
Right.
And the founders were saying, because the militia is how we had won freedom from Europe, from England,
right,
that same risk of tyranny could arise here in this country, as I think it has, and it's critical that citizens continue to have access to weapons that would enable them to restore the founding principles on which the country was set. Now, the two Tennessee Supreme Court cases, as I mentioned, recognized that and even discussed it back in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is, ever since about the time of Prohibition, the federal government has become a monster out of control in terms of oppression of rights. Mm-hmm. There was a case by the U.S. Supreme Court called Miller versus U.S. in 1940, which looked at this issue, and it actually quotes the two Tennessee cases.
Right.
And it basically found, as an element of its holding, that weapons that were suitable for military purposes were fully protected by the Second Amendment and were beyond regulation. What it didn't find in that case and sent the case back for further hearings was whether or not the specific weapon involved there fit into that category.
Right.
That's the last real Supreme Court case we had of significance on the Second Amendment until we got to the Heller decision in 2008. And Heller was a case where Dick Heller was involved with litigation with the municipality, the District of Columbia, over whether or not he could possess handguns in his own home without having registrations and whatnot. And Justice Scalia wrote in a very lengthy opinion, and it was a 5-4 decision, which means it's always going to be in jeopardy
right.
as long as we have people like some of our current justices on the Supreme Court.
Right.
But what they said in Heller was essentially what we just discussed. Scalia reaffirmed that it was an individual right, that it was a right to own weapons that were commonly owned by civilians. He didn't go so far as to deal with the military aspect of the weapons because it was unnecessary in that case.
Right.
He made the finding that in that particular facts, the municipality had violated Dick Heller's rights by regulating excessively his access to firearms. So Heller didn't decide all of the issues, but right. what it did find was that the Second Amendment protects a fundamental right of an individual, and it's a right that's beyond the regulatory authority of either the federal constitution or, as a result of the McDonald decision 2 years later, state constitutions.
Right. So I think I keep coming back, and you do too, to this word inalienable rights. In other words, it's a right that supersedes government. Government doesn't have the authority to separate us from that right.
Yes.
Okay.
Basically inseparable.
So I want to turn to the current debate, but I want to just insert one question. One of the interesting things that happened to me when I moved to Tennessee, I decided to start reading the serious history of any academic research had been done on what the impact was of owning firearms versus gun control. And one of the books I found that I really appreciated was Point Blank, which was done by an academician who had a lot of help from the firearms, some of the firearms association, to get the statistics. And what you see again and again and again in the statistics is that gun ownership and gun training do a remarkable amount to protect the honest citizens. And I'll just say this as a woman, particularly women. And to me, the statistics are overwhelmingly and compellingly clear. And yet that message never comes through in the popular media.
Oh, no, they've got no motive or incentive at all to bring that message out. As truthful as it is, it's contrary to their beliefs. And so they're not going to bring it out. But you're exactly right. The data shows legal possession of firearms by an armed populace decreases, particularly violent crimes directed towards other individuals.
Right.
It may result in increased property crimes because criminals got to make a living, apparently. But it does have a material decrease. It has a general deterrent effect.
Right.
As criminals increasingly are denied the knowledge of whether or not a potential victim is armed. Right. And so the higher the percentage of people in a society that are carrying armed, concealed particularly, the better it is for everybody, even those who don't want to carry guns.
Right, right. Okay, so let's go into the current debate, because you're in the middle of, as we said, a significant bill flow, but there's been some real issues and discussion and effort around constitutional carry and red flag laws. So tell us about that. And I also am going to want to ask you about, what is a sanctuary state?
Well, the let's talk constitutional carry, because when I started doing this a quarter century ago, we referred to it as Vermont carry. And it was because the state of Vermont has had in its constitution since the 1700s that any citizen could legally possess any weapon, could carry it. Mm-hmm. And so back then it was, we want Vermont carry, just like we used to talk about Xerox copiers, not because they owned them all, but because it was just common terminology.
Right.
Now, as of today, in the last 25 years, we have 18 states, including Vermont, that have adopted constitutional carry. And the terminology is critical. Constitutional carry means anyone who can legally possess a firearm can carry it in public for whatever legal purposes they want to, you know, exercise. It may be self-defense. It may be because they're a business owner and they want to protect their business. But constitutional carry is any legal possessor, any legal weapon. Of the states that have adopted constitutional carry, the 18, depending on how you count them, at least 8 and potentially as many as 10 even allow 18-year-olds and up to have access to firearms, because under state and federal law, at least in Tennessee, an 18-year-old can legally possess handguns, rifles, and shotguns.
Right.
They can't buy a handgun from a licensed dealer, but they can buy it from another individual. They can be gifted. They can inherit it, but they can't buy it from a dealer until they're 21, but they can legally possess it.
Right.
And so we see now in Tennessee at least 3 bills running that would adopt, change Tennessee law substantially and adopt constitutional carry. The best bill, in all likelihood, is House Bill 18, which basically says that if you legally possess it, you can carry it. And it goes a little further and it gets rid of some gun-free zone issues.
Right.
There's a second bill that is Senate Bill 1391, which approaches the issue a little differently. What it does is it just deletes entirely the sentence in our code that says it's illegal to carry a firearm with the intent to go armed. And it leaves the language in the code that says, but if you're a convicted felon and you've not had your rights restored, it's a felony for you to have a gun. And that gets us to the same point, ultimately. Then there's the governor's bill. And it was filed last year. It was moving forward, and then COVID hit. And it's back again this year. And it is an improvement over where we are now, but it is not what I would call constitutional carry. Because it has a higher threshold, It doesn't apply to everyone who can legally possess. It doesn't apply to everyone equally. So there's probably or potentially an equal rights violation built into the language of their bill.
Right.
And it's got some other conditions in it that really don't, I don't understand why they're there unless they're to create a trap. But there are these three bills, and now they're starting to move forward. They were heard in the House subcommittees this week. They'll be back in those subcommittees next week for a vote. The Senate takes up the governor's bill next mm-hmm. Tuesday. So things are starting to gel and move forward on those bills.
And who would you say representing the policies that the Tennessee Firearms Association will like to see dominant? Who are the best legislators, the leaders in protecting the Second Amendment rights in the Tennessee legislature?
You know, that's a really tough question. And I hate to necessarily single anyone out that's currently
right.
there.
Right.
Because there are a lot of them. Okay. And like, you know, singers in the church, some people are in the choir because they can carry a tune, and some people have just as much energy, but they can't.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so we've got a lot of legislators that are very much in support of this. The problem is we do have a small number of Democrats.
Right.
And we do have what's commonly referred to, unfortunately, as rhinos and moderates.
Right.
And some of those in both parties, Democrats, but also some of the Republicans, listen to law enforcement and law enforcement like the Tennessee Sheriff's Association claiming it's a risk to allow citizens to carry guns, which is complete balderdash, because not a right. single one of those other 18 states that have done it have seen a spike in criminal use by legal gun owners.
Right.
But they listen to them, and then some of them have just these, you know, they just don't concede that the Second Amendment says shall not be infringed. They'll right. say, I support the Second Amendment, and they always then, before the period even comes out of their mouth, they go, but. Right. And then they want training, they want background checks, they want, you know, recertifications, they want fees. And what that tells us is they don't really support or understand the Second Amendment.
Right. So what in the world is, let's talk about red flag laws. So I kind of see the people who'd like to wipe out the Second Amendment, they've given up trying to do it boldly or directly. They're just trying to chip away. You know, this is Chinese water torture. So talk about red flag laws, because I think yeah. there's huge danger in these.
They are a huge danger. And there's one pending in Tennessee this year. I don't think it'll pass because both of the sponsors are Democrats, but we've had them in the past filed by Republicans. And a red flag law is a kind of law that says if a person has contacts or run-ins with law enforcement or officials, like the Parkland incident down in Florida.
Right.
There was a history of contacts between the shooter and law enforcement, and law enforcement, because of federal policies of the Obama administration, didn't move forward on the juvenile and take corrective actions.
Right.
What a red flag law says is if you have people and there's any indication at all, not that they've committed a crime, it doesn't require any kind of criminal activity, but just that they might be a risk to the public or to law enforcement or themselves if they continue to possess firearms, then a red flag law lets family members, school administrators, law enforcement, almost anybody, go to a judge, swear out an ex parte affidavit, and then get an order from the judge to go seize the person's weapons.
Right.
Which to me is ludicrous, because if the danger is the mental status of the person, maybe we need to be putting the person in for psychiatric monitoring and assessment. Because if you just go take their guns, they're still a risk.
Right.
But the red flag laws aren't really towards public safety. The red flag laws, like you said, are all designed to chip away at and give government more authority to seize and disarm the public.
Right. And if you look at the power of the U.S. government, I have not seen this with Tennessee, but the U.S. government to smear people in a way which I would describe as highly inappropriate. You know, the political abuse of a provision like this could be extraordinary.
Oh, it's going to be horrible. Right. If they ever pass it, and they have in some states, it's going to become weaponized in divorces, weaponized in domestic matters, weaponized politically.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's not going to be a real tool. If they legitimately want to deal with someone who's a potential risk, we already have laws on the books. In Tennessee, they're called extreme risk protection orders, okay? Right. Emergency committal orders, where once there's a doctor's affidavit that the person constitutes a material risk to themselves or a third person, they can be involuntarily seized for up to 2 weeks for medical assessment and treatment.
Right.
And then there's a court hearing on whether or not they're released. They don't go take their gun any more than they go take their knives or their lawnmower or their chainsaw or their car.
Right.
That's what's wrong with red flag laws. They're not about safety. They're about seizing guns.
Right. Okay, so what in the world is a sanctuary state?
A sanctuary state is a term that I don't recommend we use. The concept of a sanctuary state, I think, comes from the left, and it comes from people that refuse to honor the national immigration laws or the the marijuana laws or some other law, but typically it's immigration.
Right.
And what a sanctuary, when you use the term sanctuary city or sanctuary state, means it is, there's not even a challenge or a dispute as to whether or not the law in issue, like let's take immigration, is a valid exercise of government power.
Mm-hmm.
The sanctuary concept says we don't care. I mean, just like the Old Testament sanctuary cities, we don't care what the law is. We're not going to let you enforce it here. And in fact, we're going to do everything we can by aiding and abetting the criminals to keep you from enforcing it.
Right.
The reason I don't like that in the context of Second Amendment issues is that Second Amendment is not a sanctuary concept. There is no doubt that the Constitution says federal laws and now state laws that infringe are unconstitutional.
Right.
So when it comes to the Second Amendment, I prefer referring to them as either Second Amendment or 10th Amendment laws.
Right.
Because it's not a sanctuary concept. We are, in fact, dealing with a government that's exceeded its powers, exceeded its delegated authority, that's acting ultra vires, and that has no constitutional jurisdiction if you were in front of a real court.
Right. One of the reasons that, this is an aside from your point of view, but one of the reasons I feel so strongly about these issues, in particularly in the state in which I live, is right now you're watching a significant change in the currency system, and it's what the central banks have voted on, a plan called the Going Direct Reset. And there's no doubt in my mind that you have tremendous reasons why many financial interests would love to buy significantly more real estate in the United States and farmland. And that process, I believe, is going to be much easier to do politically if you can institute gun control in the population.
Well, it may. I mean, there's...
Right.
From the left's perspective, from the socialist perspective, from the communist perspective, getting rid of private civilian ownership of guns has innumerable benefits. But that's been proven. It was proven in Russia, North Korea, China,
right?
You know, Canada, Australia. It's been proven over and over again. If you want to go down the cesspool of destroying a constitutional republic, you got to disarm the public.
Right, right. So I would just notice, you know, I think I said this to you before, the number one drop-off point at U-Haul in 2020 was Nashville. Did you know that?
I've heard that.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about what can I do. What, somebody's listening to this, maybe they live in Tennessee, maybe they live in another state, maybe they live in another country. What can a person do?
Well, That's a great question. And that's one reason Tennessee Firearms Association continues to function as a grassroots organization. And it's based upon the principle that we maximize our efficiency in dealing with our elected officials.
Right.
If we're exercising the Article I rights that we have and responsibilities to lecture and instruct and then hold our elected officials accountable.
Right.
And so we don't use paid lobbyists. You know, what TFA does is we try to put information out and make it easily digestible through weekly updates, through, we've just started podcasting. We're starting to do video work.
Your podcasts are excellent. They are very, very simple, clear explanation of these issues. And if you could just give your URL, because you can just click over to the podcast. And I think if you don't understand these issues, they're very, very good.
The website is Tennessee Firearms, all spelled out, .com. And then on the main page, there's a link directly to the podcast.
Right.
And also on the main page is a direct link to a subscribe button. And if you, that's free. You don't even have to be a member. It's the same way with the podcast. They're free. You get on the subscribe list and we send you, matter of fact, I've sent out three today, legislative updates on the status of bills that had activity this week, of bills that are scheduled for committee next week, what's good or bad about the bills, and other information that relates to the progress of the bills. And then we do things like we say, here are the talking points on the bills. Here's what's good or bad about them. And here are the people you need to call and tell them that you're an informed TFA supporter and what you want them to do. And I know from talking to legislative staffers that when we send that kind of email out, they get overrun with phone calls. So I know we've got a big saturation and I know we're being effective in educating and supporting the efforts of individuals. But when it comes down to the question of what can someone do, unlike organizations that just want to send you an invoice and get membership dollars.
Right.
And don't let me suggest that membership dollars aren't important, because it's what funds the podcast and all the stuff.
Right.
But some organizations don't want you involved. They want you to send them all the money and let them make the decisions. And in my opinion, they've messed up in Tennessee.
Right.
It made it worse. TFA, what we try to do is we want to have an informed, supporting membership and have them active and speaking with legislators and putting the pressure on. And I don't think you'll find another organization that provides the level of information and support to the members in terms of educating them on the issues with timely information that we try to provide, at least on Second Amendment issues.
What I love about what you provide is it's not there's sufficient complexity to understand and deal effectively. It's not oversimplified. So let me ask you this. If somebody's in another state, is there a Tennessee Firearms Association in the other 49 states?
There are many. As a matter of fact, I deal with many of them. You know, Virginia has the Virginia Citizens Defense League, VCDL. I can't rattle off the names of all of them. That's just one I got an email from today. But Missouri, Montana, Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, most of the states have state-based organizations. And my experience over the last quarter century is the state-based organizations are typically run by volunteers. They're typically run by people who are far more educated or informed on the nuances of that state's law.
Right.
Because I'm going to contrast it. I'm an attorney. I've been doing this for 25 years. I practice it as an attorney, and then I volunteer my time. And in contrast, the NRA has a part-time lobbyist that covers Tennessee and five states. He was a staffer on Bill Lee's administration, so he's not going to stand up to Lee and hold him accountable.
Right.
And that's all the NRA has sent down here for the last 25 years. They don't send in dedicated advocates that don't have conflicts of interest.
Right. So, and I also think if you're going to deal with these issues at a state level, you need to be focused. So, I always try and encourage my subscribers to take attention away from the national level and start putting a lot more attention at the state level, where their time and their dollars can really hold the line on these kinds of issues. Because it's funny, I was just reading something. I don't know if you saw it. There was an article, and it got quotes from the New Hampshire group, the equivalent of the TFA in New Hampshire. Yeah. And the guy basically very cleverly said, you know, their tagline on their driver's, on their car tags is live free or die. And they're very serious about it up in New Hampshire anyway. So this guy said, you know, I don't notice the Secret Service agents who are guarding the Biden family giving up their guns. You know, our children deserve the same protection. And I thought, oh, this administration is in for a fight in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that the depth of the talent, the intelligence, the knowledge, and the history that's ready to battle state by state over these issues.
It is. I mean, and I think it's at the state level is where you find it. It's the national groups can do some things well. Some of the national groups can do some things well. Like, for example, the Second Amendment Foundation.
Right.
It focuses its attention on litigation in the courts. And as a matter of fact, the Tennessee Firearms Association works with SAF, and we've joined in amicus briefs with both SAF and Gun Owners of America. And in fact, we were a party to litigation in the U.S. Supreme Court over the last 2 years.
Right.
At national support. And so, you know, we go beyond just working in the legislature. We've now gotten into increasingly over the last 10 years, selectively picking lawsuits to either fund, assist in, or start up ourselves.
Right. So let's say I want to purchase and own a firearm. I'm the kind of person who thought I would never do it. And now suddenly I'm looking at the world and I'm saying, oh, now I realize why people want to own a firearm. How do I begin? Where do I go? How do I get training? How do I get educated?
Yeah, those are great questions. I would start off if you're a complete novice, you know, which occurs particularly with the number of people that have moved into Tennessee. Most Tennesseans native, if they don't already own guns, they got a brother or a father or grandfather that does, it can help them.
Right.
A lot of people have come in that doesn't apply to is go to a professional range/ gun store. Now they're in the business of selling you stuff, including range time, but they also have licensed, certified professional instructors.
Right.
And one thing that I like to tell people, and this is because I defend people who are involved in self-defense cases, is if your instructor's only certification is they went through the 2-day NRA instructor course, find another instructor.
Right.
Get someone who has law enforcement experience, has military experience, comes from a really rigorous training background, like Blackwater or Thunder Ranch or some of those, and pick someone who could potentially be a good witness if you had to have someone testify on your level of training.
Right.
But get the right kind of training. And don't necessarily go buy the gun before you've gotten the training, because they've got rental guns.
Right.
And the reason is most people buy the wrong gun because they're talking to a salesman instead of an instructor that can help them select a weapon that's suitable for them. And not everybody needs an automatic, a semi-automatic. Some people actually do better with revolvers because they're simpler. There's less to break. You don't have to maintain them as like you do a semi-auto.
Right.
So go talk to a qualified instructor that's got real experience, and there's plenty of them around.
So one of the things I thought was great about the instructor I had in Tennessee was their knowledge of the law, because you really need to know the law if you're going to handle a weapon in Tennessee.
You do. And that's a serious deficiency with a lot of instructors.
Right.
They don't realize it, but I constantly get questions through the Facebook, social media, where people say, my instructor said the law was this, and it's just not that way.
Right. Right. You have to know the law. Okay, so let's talk about how, whether it's the Tennessee Firearms Association or their state or you know, for whatever country they're in, you know, I always say, what's the point of having assets if you don't have an army to support, you know, to defend them? So this to me is very critical to defending your human rights and your property rights. How do they support TFA or their state group or their country group? They can join membership.
Mm-hmm.
They can donate.
Yes.
Some of them have PACs. You have a PAC. I didn't realize you had a PAC until I prepared for this interview, and I thought, okay.
Yeah.
Now I know where
we've had a PAC since 96. I mean, we're uh-huh. we realized early on that if you're going to be effective, you got to have the ability right. to
contribute support
the right candidates and work right. to take out the bad ones.
So you and I went about the same time to MeWe. We left Twitter and went to MeWe.
Yeah.
So you do have a social communication on your behalf with representatives is very, very important. So,
yes.
So if you put out a broadcast, you know, getting to know your state representatives and getting your voice heard is very important. What about communication with media on behalf? So you do a podcast. You know, now that I'm on your update list, if I know you're doing a podcast, then I can republish it. So support with media. What about anything at the national level that you could recommend that people do?
At the national level, we do have a crisis. And I recommend people look at a couple of organizations for support at the national level. Second Amendment Foundation is strong because we can achieve some things in the courts that we're not going to achieve under a Biden administration.
Okay.
You know, and they're well run. They're longstanding. They're good at what they do. Right. I do strongly support Gun Owners of America. They work okay. both at the state level with legislative advocacy as well as right. at the court and federal levels. And right. they do a good job of it. Because they're dedicated and they're not in it for seven-figure salaries.
So how dangerous is it that the Republicans have lost the Senate? Because I always saw the Republican control of the Senate as being sort of a protection on the Second Amendment.
I think it's devastating, potentially.
Right.
And I think it increases the risk that we're going to have to rely almost exclusively on victories in the court system for the next couple of years. Because unless we turn a couple of House or a couple of Senate members to defeat stuff in Congress, they can do what they want, just like they did with Obamacare, and right. it'll be a disaster for the nation. And then we've got the problem that Joe Biden will sign any executive order put in front of him. I don't even think he reads them.
Right.
He certainly can't articulate what they mean.
Right.
He just will sign anything. And that's a huge problem because once he puts it down in an executive order, it doesn't mean if it's valid or not. Federal organizations are going to start trying to implement it. And what we saw during the Trump administration was over and over and over again, things that were probably constitutionally permissible by Trump were attacked almost immediately by right. the left by going into the district courts and trying to get injunctions.
Right.
And what we see is a complete failure, largely on the behalf of the establishment Republicans in this country, to use the same tactics to go to the courts and try to get injunctive relief to stop the Biden administration from trampling on our rights and a constitutional republic's proper functioning.
Right. So this is a question coming from my complete ignorance. We see states starting to pass nullification laws. Does any of that have to do with the Second Amendment and their fear of what a Biden administration would do?
I think some of it does. And those kinds of laws, and we see one, there's two actually in Tennessee, they need to be stronger. The pending bills need to be stronger. And we're working on that. But that's a 10th Amendment issue as well as a Second Amendment. I mean, the two work hand in hand.
Right.
And what's going to happen, the state can pass all the laws they want to, and the federal government's going to go, we don't care.
Right.
And the federal officials with the ATF or the FBI or whoever it is, they're going to go, we don't care, until a federal district judge puts down an injunction.
Right.
Then they'll care. And so the states are going to have to require that their attorney generals Right. Tennessee is not good in this component because we have not had a history of strong attorney generals because they're not elected by the public.
Right.
But they're going to have to require that their attorney generals forcefully take action and push back against federal encroachments if we want to see any kind of buffer to what the Biden administration is going to do.
So as a citizen of the state, where does a citizen put pressure to get the attorney generals to do that? Is it by pressuring the governor's office?
No, it's putting pressure on the legislature.
The legislature
controls the attorney general's budget. That's how you control him.
Gotcha. It's always the travel money.
Well, what we need to do is we need to transform Tennessee to an elected attorney general.
Right.
And there's two routes to that. We can amend the Constitution, which takes 6 to 7 years to do, even if you started today.
Right.
Or we can recognize that when you read the state constitution about the attorney general, yeah, it's a constitutional office, and the attorney general is appointed by the Supreme Court. But the structure of the constitution is that's because the attorney general was supposed to be part of the Supreme Court's staff originally. They were the reporter that published the books. And most of the problem is that over the last two centuries, the General Assembly has delegated specific powers statutorily to the Attorney General that aren't in the Constitution, which is okay. Right. If you had an Attorney General that was capable and responsive. So what the legislature could do without having to amend the Constitution is they could create, for example, another office, call it Solicitor General or whatever you want to call it, make it an elected office, and then by statute transfer powers from the AG to this new office that is elected, and we could be up and running with a real aggressive advocate for the public within 2 years.
Has anybody considered doing that? Has anybody ever sponsored a bill to do that?
We have talked with them, selected representatives and senators, about doing that. They keep filing bills to tweak how the attorney general operates. There's one pending this year.
Right.
But it's not the right path. Senator Beavers did do it when she was there several years ago, but she retired. And so presently there's not a bill pending that uses this concept of creating a separate office and transferring authority.
Right. I think it's pretty intelligent. Okay. So Biden administration, what keeps you up at night?
You know, there comes a time when you just got to look to your beliefs, you know, the 23rd Psalm, for example, and say that it doesn't matter. He can kill me, but he can't eat me.
Right.
And at some point, you have to also realize that the reason we have this country in the first place is because citizens finally had enough and stood up to their Washington at the time, which was King George,
right,
and told him no more. We're going to rule ourselves.
Right.
Now, you would hope we don't get to that point, that maybe by the ballot box and changing things, we could recover and restore the constitutional republic. With voter fraud and the Biden administration coming into power when there's no way that goofball won. You got to wonder if it's ever going to be a viable option.
Right.
So you hope we're never going to have to go the route of the Second Amendment, but that's what it took in the 1700s. And it's my belief that at that time, the offenses of tyranny that are enumerated in the Declaration are far less than what we're dealing with today.
Yeah, no, that is true. That is true. So I want to tell you just one last story before we close. When I read the article about the U-Haul it and the number one drop-off point, according to the spokesperson for U-Haul it being Tennessee, you know, the first thing that came to my mind? I said, every real estate broker in the state of Tennessee should call the Tennessee Firearms Association and say, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you, you know, wanting to set this up and having this long discussion. It is critical. One of the things I hear, I mean, and I don't know how to solve the problem, but I hear constantly people will hear me out doing public speaking or something, and they go, I didn't even know y'all existed.
Really?
And you know, and I'm on the internet, we're on television, we do all this stuff, and it's like, where have you been? You know, but yeah, we're here and we need support and we need, it's a numbers game. You know, right. We got 700,000 handgun permit holders in the state.
Right.
If we had 10% of that number calling the legislature on constitutional carry, elected attorney generals, 10th Amendment, if we had just 10% of the permit holders calling, or 5%, it'd get done overnight. You know, they would respond.
I'm ashamed. I'm going to do a better job of calling and writing in the future.
Well, so many people think it doesn't make a difference.
Oh, no, it does. I'll never forget. I'll tell you a story. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I got a call from a congressman's office, and they said, we've had a huge increase in our mail on housing. Could you come talk to us about housing? We want to make sure the congressman is taking action and doing something on housing. And I got over there and I said, you know, where's all this mail coming from? How many letters did you get? They said, we got 3 last week.
It makes a difference.
But a personal handwritten letter.
I tell people, I mean, because I deal with a lot of the staffers. Right. You're wasting your time sending emails, because an email is just a delete button waiting to happen.
Right.
You know, it's going to take personal phone calls, face-to-face visits, particularly in the district. Don't come to Nashville because they're too busy. Catch them at Walmart or the grocery store or at church or the bowling alley or the pizza parlor. Catch them in the district and talk to them. And then write a letter. You can fax it in. You can mail it in.
If they have community meetings,
Some do, some don't.
Some do.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've found them to be, one of the things I love about Tennessee is that working in government is a very honorable career in Tennessee. And it's a very high quality of people who work in Tennessee. Now, I'm saying that because some of them are my relatives.
Yeah. There are a lot of them that fit that mold.
I know. Okay, well, John Harris, I think what you do for our state is fantastic. If there's anything I can ever do to help, I hope you will let me know. And, we need to do a better job of supporting you. And I think you're making an enormous difference. And the states, you know, with the Republicans losing the Senate, what's going on nationally, a lot of the responsibility to hold the line is going to come down to the state legislatures.
Yeah.
So,
and I'll tell you, I mean, I've learned this clearly. It takes money. I'll give you an example. When I first got involved doing this stuff, and actually for the first 10 or 15 years, you could run a house race, a state house race in Tennessee for $10,000 to $25,000.
Right.
Easy, all day long. We went after the number 3 Republican in the House in 2012, because she admitted to us that the House leadership, Republicans, they're all Republicans, were unwilling to let gun bills come to the floor because they were more interested in protecting incumbents on reelection from challenges from Democrats than they were letting the bills to the floor, because their reasoning was, if we put gun bills on the floor, the Democrats will use it against us in our campaign cycles.
Right.
And I'm going like, you're an idiot. You'll get more votes if you do the right thing, just like Trump proved.
Right.
But anyhow, so in that race, we found a Tea Party leader that was a dynamo, and we went after that number 3 person in the House. What should have been $20,000 to $50,000 in campaign cost, that one race was like $750,000 on both sides.
Wow.
And so now what we know is, if it's a state house race, that candidate better be able to raise, and the organizations like TFA supporting them, about $100,000 per race.
Right.
And if you're going after a Senate seat, it's like $500,000.
Right.
And you have to realize that the Chamber of Commerce loves Rhino Republicans.
Right.
So the Chamber of Commerce will throw money at them. and keep the rhinos in office. And those are the ones really that are creating more problems in Tennessee than the Democrats, because the Democrats could caucus in a minivan at McDonald's. They're not that many of them.
Right.
But the rhino Republicans are like a cancer.
Right.
When it comes to constitutional conservative issues. And they just keep eroding the progress that could be made by their unwillingness to stand up for the Constitution.
Well, what I'm hoping is the events of the last 4 or 5 years have helped to galvanize the general population to realize they've got to get in the fray. And it's not enough to get in the fray at the national level. They've got to get into the fray at the local and state level, because this is all going to come down to the quality of leadership.
Absolutely. State officials, federal officials start off as local school board members, local commission members, local mayors, maybe even the road superintendents. And then those people get a little experience with government.
Right.
And then they go to the state legislature. And then they go like Marsha Blackburn. She went from the state Senate to Congress.
Right.
And then they go from the state legislature to governor or Congress, or try to run for vice president.
Right.
And so if you don't be dedicated at the local level, and Nashville's sucking air.
Right.
And trying to keep out people who are not constitutional stewards, doing it for the right reason, then you're losing the battle as they gain tactics, skill, and support moving towards the General Assembly. So it's critical that you, as you said, that you start fighting local and state races with a vengeance, because you've got to keep the cesspool from infecting the upper level races where you can't afford to fight.
Yeah, I used to have a colleague who would describe it as unrelenting, unceasing, unremitting pressure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, John Harris, I think you're going to have a great year. We're here to support you. Thank you so much for joining me on the Solaria Report. You have a wonderful day.
I've enjoyed it. Let's do it again in a few months.
I would love to.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.